What's up, everybody? Welcome to the TNT Wellness and Nutrition Podcast. I'm Thomas.
I'm Tyson. Let's get this started. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of TNT Wellness and Nutrition Podcast. This is episode 33. We're going to be talking about rabbit starvation, aka protein poisoning, and really diving into the science behind why you simply can't eat protein 100% 365 and survive. Like, you will die straight up. So we're going to talk about that. But first, a little check-in. So Tom, how's your week been?
So I set a new PR on my longest distance run. I did 15 miles. So the last PR was 12. And I got to 12 miles, no problem. 13 miles, no problem. 13 and a half, holy shit, it got hard.
Is this a treadmill?
This is a treadmill. Okay. The weather just hasn't been holding up nice enough for me to do one of these runs outside. Hopefully that'll change in the next couple weeks. It's just been raining too much up here. I don't know. I'm too spoiled by that California weather to be running out in the rain.
So when you say it went hard, you mean muscles burning, fatigue, what?
Yeah, pretty much everything. Everything? Like, yeah. I just hit that wall, and I was just like, okay. I was like, you know what? My goal was 15. I was like, I'll hit 15. If I didn't have that goal, I would have just stopped at 13 and a half. 13, I was okay. Just, like, powering through. I, like, dropped the speed down so low. I was pretty much just running with my upper body. If you looked at my feet, they were walking. Yeah. I was just, like, running with the arms in motion. I tried to, like, kick it back up. I was like, okay, I only got a mile left. You know, I can go hard. No, I couldn't. Yeah. Did, like, one lap. Probably not even one lap like that. I had to drop it back down. I kept trying to bring it back to, like, a decent pace. Didn't really do it very well, but whatever.
How did your lungs feel, like, burnt?
It was mostly my legs.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Like, my hamstrings were so tight. My calves were just so tight after that.
Normally, like, just pumped?
Yeah, just, like, I felt like I was going to pull the muscle if I were to go another, like, 2 miles.
Okay.
Which I thought was kind of a good thing, because if I'm going to run 26 miles, there's a good chance that I'm going to have to fight through that pain. So I was like, you know what? Like, hey, I can fight through this pain for a good 10, 15 minutes. Just get that mental toughness, so... It was good practice doing that. So another thing I was looking up, the different marathons in the area that are coming up. Some of them are sold out. Some of them are so damn expensive. I'm not about to spend $200 to run 26 miles and torture myself. I don't know who's got that kind of, who's investing money into that.
Why, hold on, but why are you paying to begin? You can't just show up and run?
That's what I was thinking. Yeah, me too. I might just run 26 miles just to say it.
Yeah.
But I found two marathons that are affordable, that are like less than 100. One's all flat. It's in Fremont. So I might do that one. But then there's another one that's in Berkeley. And they also offer an ultra marathon with that. So ultra marathon is anything that's longer than a marathon. So it could be 30 miles, it could be 100 miles. So they offer a 30-mile one there. So I might do the ultra marathon that's 30 miles. Not 26, 30, not that big of a difference.
I guess.
And now I get that ultra marathon title with it.
I didn't know that anything over 26 was considered ultra. When you said ultra, I honestly, in my brain, went to 100.
You were thinking like 50, 100?
Yes, uh-huh.
No, it's just anything over a normal marathon.
Okay.
But the catch with that one is the elevation. So the elevation change in Fremont is like, I think, 120 meters, nothing. The one in Berkeley, 6,700 meters.
Wow, that's a big difference.
Yeah, that's a ton of hills.
Wow, jeez.
So I'm going to start...
So that just means over the course of the 30 miles, you're going up and down that much.
Yes.
That's exactly. A lot. That's a huge number.
And running 30 miles.
On top of it.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm going to start doing... Luckily, there's a lot of hills in our area. So I'm going to start doing some outdoor runs with the hills and see how I do. I don't know. I did cross country in high school, and I always did fine with hills. I got short little legs. They're kind of built for running up a hill.
Yeah.
But I've never done anything with, like, you know, 10-plus miles with a bunch of hills. So I'm just going to see how that affects me and see if I can do that. If not, I'm just going to kind of go the easy route and just do the flat 26-mile. Yeah.
Oh, I mean... To me, that shit all sounds like torture. Like, I have no desire in my heart to run that much, but I would go for the Fremont one. But it would be cool if out the gate you did a ultra marathon that was hella hilly.
I only think I'm going to do this once. It's not that I don't hate running, but it's just hard to schedule the time to run for 3 hours or 4 hours, something along those lines. It's really hard to find the time to practice that. And I'm at that age where, you know, like kids are in the near future and stuff like that. I don't know how I'm going to find time to run for 4 hours on a Saturday, you know, if I got kids. Like, that just doesn't seem very practical.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we were talking about a guy named Zach Bitter earlier. He's one of the best ultra marathon runners in the world. And he talks about his training sessions, like when he does like doubles. He's training for 6, 8, 12 hours a day. Like, that's his job.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
I mean, if I got good enough where I could get paid to do it, that'd be one thing.
You'd do it.
Yeah, but like, this is on top of me working. So it's like, yeah, it's not really in the cards.
Yeah.
I gotta sleep sometime, you know.
You gotta eat maybe once or twice. Yeah.
So I think now that I said it on the podcast, I think I'm kind of forced to do the ultra marathon.
Oh, yeah, for real. That'd be cool, man. That'd be really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good luck. I do not want to do that.
But I don't know. We'll see. How's everything going with you?
Everything's been good. I feel like I'm just getting into my stride with this diet to summer. So it's a little 12-week cut. It's week 3 now. And I feel like my body is really starting to finally adjust. I feel like I'm getting leaner literally by like the minute. It's what it feels like. The hunger cues and transition period I felt the first few weeks have definitely died down. Like, I've gotten into a groove. And it just sucks. I think I'm the only guy who's like upset that he's actually going on vacation. So remember I told you me and my wife are going to Mendocino?
Yeah.
For like, so we're going up there Friday to Sunday, and like, we have to go. Like, I can't back out now. Like, the hotel's paid for and all that type of stuff. But it's just bad timing for me because I really am hitting my stride and I feel really good. But I am making, I guess, tweaks to survive out there and not really fall off the wagon too much. So, I mean, I guess I haven't told you this. You can tell me what you think about this. So really what I'm thinking, I'm not going to be crazy and bring like all my Tupperware out there to eat throughout the day, because I know we're going to be at different places doing different things throughout the day. But I know at least one time I'm going to be in the hotel. It's actually like a little cabin. I'll be in the cabin at least one time during the day. That's in the morning, right? I know I'm going to wake up there every day. So I'm going to treat it like a OMAD style diet. So one meal a day diet. So I'm going to get all my meals in that I would be eating now just in one meal. So pretty much 200 grams of protein, 100 grams of fat in one meal in the morning. And then that way my protein's covered. And I fully suspect I'm going to eat some sort of, it's going to be like the carnivore and cookies diet. Like, I just know it is because my wife has already marked out all like the fucking ice cream shops in like a 3 mile block. So I know it's going to happen. So as long as I get my protein in for those 3 days that I'm out there, I'm going to consider that a victory. And I made sure, I guess I am kind of crazy, I made sure my wife got a cabin that had a fridge and a microwave so I could bring my stuff and get it all prepped. So that's my plan. What do you think?
That should work out, especially if you do that early in the day. You're not really going to have to worry about, I'm starving, I need to eat 3 bowls of ice cream.
Exactly. Like,
your stomach should be good. Mm-hmm. Like, those hunger cues should be pretty good.
My like willpower should be pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, that doesn't seem like a bad plan.
That's what I got. That's all I could think of how to do it.
So are you more worried about, like, the diet while you're gone? Or just, like, I'm skipping training? Or is it the combination?
It's definitely the combination. And it's really, it's the ice cream and, like, cookies. And because I'm not going to be super militant while I'm out there, just because it's not fun going on vacation with a guy who doesn't want to go to the ice cream shop, doesn't want to go to the candy shop, doesn't want to go out to dinner. Like, I don't want to do it to my wife. Like, I want to be social. I want to go to these places with her. So I'm just more worried about that because, like I said, I'm just getting in the groove. I'm just starting to get leaner, and I really notice it. But I'm worried about that. As far as taking days off from training, overall, it's going to be about 5 days off. And that's kind of a blessing in disguise. I told you a while back I hurt my shoulder.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, we talked about that in a couple podcasts.
We did, right? Okay. So still dealing with it. Like, I've been, it's just, I'm smarter than this. I'm actually being really dumb doing this. Like, I've been working around the injury. So, like, I'm working out, and if exercise hurts my shoulder, I just kind of modify it so it doesn't hurt my shoulder that much. It's stupid. I should just take time off for, like, 2 weeks and not do anything. But I just haven't been because I'm one, I love working out, and one, I'm really dialed into this diet. I want to keep training. So taking this many days off hopefully will get everything healed up.
Well, that's what got me wanting to do a marathon, is I still want to work out, but I've had my shoulders been bothering me for like over a year, kind of doing the same thing as you. So I was like, hey, this is a way I can still train, get that itch, but also let my shoulder heal.
Yeah.
And my shoulders, I don't know, it feels great.
Doesn't bother you?
No, not at all. So yeah, I think it worked.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, so as long as you just stay busy out there, not really worry about it.
Yeah, I'm trying not to.
Yeah.
And we're going to go on hikes. That's like the main thing to do out there. It's like a more nature-related vacation. So go on hikes and like visit some national parks out there. So I'm still going to be getting some sort of work in. But mainly just hopefully my shoulder recovers. Hopefully when I get back to just normal life, I'll be able to hit the gym hard. And these last 8 weeks, I can't wait for it, honestly. And again, I fully understand. Don't point this out to me. In like 3 weeks, I'm going to be complaining. I know I'm going to be bitching about being starving and skinny and tired. And but for right now, I feel good. I'm ready to go. Even though I do already have people calling me skinny, I do already have people asking me, like, is everything okay? You know what I mean? So, and I told them, like, the people who do know what I do, I was like, oh, I'm only 3 weeks in. I was like, I have 9 more weeks to go. If you think I'm skinny now, wait, just fucking wait. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, I don't care. Like, I'm going to push. I'm going to go hard. And my goal is to match, or at least match, if not succeed, the level of conditioning I had for Thanksgiving. And I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it without cutting my calories anymore. I'm going to do it just by manipulating my protein levels and my fat levels, but keeping my calories the same. Because I've learned from my last cut. And once I'm done with this, we'll do a whole podcast on the results and what I did and how I did it. Just to
compare the two?
Yeah, compare the two. Because I feel like I'm doing it smarter this time. Or at least, I hope so.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm not done yet, so.
Well, one thing we were talking about earlier is when you do go low carb, especially for a very long time, anytime you do start to eat carbs, your muscles just soak up that glycogen, and you're not really going to have a big blood sugar spike because your body's not going to be wanting to use that for fuel. It's been running off of ketones for so long. So I wouldn't really worry about having like too many like bad effects from eating like some ice cream or some cookies. Your muscles are going to love it, love all that glucose and just soak them up.
Yeah, right now it has a place to go. Exactly. Yeah, carrying a little extra muscle is, like I've said a million times, like a glucose sink. So it gives your body a place to dump glucose. So hopefully when I come back on Monday, I'm going to be swole as shit. Hopefully I'm not fat. So we'll see, you know.
Don't take that advice. That's not fit for everybody. Like
right now, yeah, my body's primed for it, for sure. Yeah, I'm definitely depleted.
Yeah, we're definitely not endorsing going out and eating a bunch of ice cream or cookies on a weekend.
Definitely not. But yeah, I guess talking about protein is a good transition for the topic of the podcast, which is rabbit starvation, also known as protein poisoning. And it's something you would think that this topic would have been covered in detail. You think you could like search rabbit starvation and you would find like 20 articles about it and why you can't strictly live on protein. But we found out that that's just simply not true.
Pretty much all you find out is if you eat too much protein, you get sick. And if you keep doing it, you die. Outside of that, it was like, good luck figuring it out for yourself.
Yeah, it's hard, you know. And we even posted things like on social media, like, hey, like I reached out to a few people on Twitter. Tom reached out to a few people on Facebook, or I guess a lot of people, like groups of people. And you pretty much get the same roundabout answers. And you realize real quick, no one really knows what's going on.
Yeah. And you know what? I don't know how many articles I've read through for this podcast and got no answers. I don't know. It was at least 15, 20. I read through like a couple chapters of a textbook on it. And really just was like, okay, you're going to have to figure this out for yourself.
Exactly. And I think we did come up with a pretty good, I guess, educated guess. Of course, we're not running studies. Of course, we didn't, like, do this on anybody. But I feel confident in the things we're saying that this really might be the mechanism of what's going on. But first, why don't you just tell them what rabbit starvation is?
So it's an observation made mostly when North American explorers, they ate nothing but rabbit meat. This is either traveling up through like northern Canada, or like Lewis and Clark experienced this as well, traveling west. So rabbits, there's tons of them, they're easy to find, so they're hunting, killing those, and that's pretty much what they're surviving off of. The only problem with that is that rabbit meat's only 60% protein and 40% fat. So mostly what we talk about is a high fat, low carb, like moderate protein type of diet. This is a high protein, moderate fat, no carbs. So these people were had a bunch of different symptoms. They were hungry all the time. They were suffering from diarrhea. They were having headaches, probably because they were dehydrated from having diarrhea. Low blood pressure, nausea, fatigue, slow heart rate, and even death.
I wouldn't even say this is a moderate fat diet. This is like a minimum fat diet. In our world, 40% fat would be a low fat diet.
Yeah, especially with the absence of carbohydrates. Yes. Not to balance it out.
Exactly, because fat's going to be an energy source. And if you're not going to run off fat, then of course carbs can be an energy source. But back in the day, this was before you could wake up and have like a granola bar for breakfast. So these people were living off the land, which meant living off the animals they could hunt. So they were eating a meat-based diet for sure.
Yeah, it's not like they were just coming across a cornfield, because those were non-existent at that time.
No, and the corn that was around, trust me, was the size of like a flower. Like they were not as big and as meaty as they are today. And I like this little part you put in about the health experts.
Yeah, so I hope you're not one of those dumbass health experts that thinks a calorie is a calorie. Because if you do, then go on this diet and let me know how you feel. Because not all calories are created equal.
Yeah, because if you want, I today could eat 2,000 calories of just protein.
Yeah, it would be really hard. Just, what, 20 chicken breasts?
Yeah, exactly. Like 20 chicken breasts. You can do it. And you can do it for maybe, I don't know, a few days, a few weeks. But it's not something you can do forever. And we're going to talk about why.
When we had the podcast with Travis, one of the things we talked about is, I forgot the doctor's name, but he's in a hospital setting on an all-meat diet.
Yeah, Stephenson.
Yeah, and they put him on pretty much this protein poisoning type of diet, and he's doing miserable on it. And then he's like, hey, let me pick the cuts of meat, pick the fatter cuts of meat, and then was thriving for the rest of the experiment. And then they just cut it short because they're like, okay, this guy's doing too well.
Yeah, exactly. If this diet is going to be about protein poisoning, what that made us look into was, what about protein is poisonous? And it is the nitrogen in protein. So our body has to break that down. And so when the body breaks down protein, specifically the nitrogen in protein, nitrogen is released. The nitrogen is then free to bind with hydrogen ions forming NH3 or ammonia. And ammonia is poisonous to the body. So the body has to convert the ammonia into urea through the urea cycle and then excrete it in the urine. And this is the only way our body deals with nitrogen. It doesn't have like a backup system. It doesn't have redundant systems that, oh, if this is working, then we can do this or that. No, the urea cycle is the only way our body handles nitrogen.
So in a book that we both read called Tripping Over the Truth, there was a drug that happened to work a little too well. So it was destroyed a tumor, and it destroyed the tumor a little too well, and there was excessive protein breakdown. And what that did was it left too much protein to metabolize, and it was forming bonds with all the nitrogen. And what that happens was ammonia poisoning, and that resulted in a coma. And a coma back then, if you're exploring, I don't know, they can't carry you along. Hey, if you're in a coma, I'm going to assume you're dead.
Exactly.
And if you're not dead, if we try to carry you along for a few thousand miles through the wilderness, we're probably going to die with you. So it's not really practical to take care of somebody in that horrible of a situation.
Exactly. And just think, like, we have to carry any food we might have on us, any clothes we might have, any tents, anything like that. That's on our backs. So there's no way I'm going to carry your 150-pound ass on top of a tent.
While you're already hungry, probably suffering from diarrhea, all these other symptoms that we already discussed.
Sorry, bro. You fell asleep and didn't wake up?
Yeah.
Better luck next time. You know what I mean? Now you're fertilizer, you know? Straight up. But specifically, I looked into what happens with ammonia poisoning. And right now I'm saying ammonia, which is NH3. Some people out there are going to be a little more up to date. If you want to talk about ammonium, which is NH4, it's cool, bro. All right. If I say ammonia and you want to say it's ammonium, it's the same thing for this argument. But what happens is the excessive ammonium, NH4, gets pushed out of the liver into the bloodstream. And our brain, we have certain cells called astrocytes, and they have a special enzyme that not many cells have in our body called glutamine synthetase. It converts glutamate into glutamine. And all you need to do to glutamate to make glutamine is add an amine group, which is basically an amino group of nitrogen. That's the only difference between glutamate and glutamine, is an extra nitrogen group. So the brain can get the nitrogen group from ammonium. So excessive NH4 leads to excessive glutamine in the brain. This is a problem because glutamine is very osmotic, meaning it draws water to it. If you remember back in our magnesium podcast, magnesium is very osmotic as well, so it draws water to it. And that's one of the reasons why excessive magnesium can cause diarrhea, is because of that factor. So this excessive glutamine in the brain sucks water into the brain, leading to cerebral edema, which is brain swelling. This increases intracranial pressure and can result in brain herniation. And if you don't know what that is, just think of a disc herniation in your back. It's pretty much like your brain bulges out, pretty much pushing up against the skull because there's just so much pressure. And this can lead to comatose. So basically, you're dead. And then that we talked about earlier, especially in these old explorer days, if you waked up or you went to bed and you didn't wake up, we wouldn't know, oh, he's just in a coma. We would think you were dead. So that's what it is.
So brain swelling, that seems like that would result in a headache, right?
100%.
One of the symptoms observed.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, since we were talking about how it's so osmotic, that would lead in diarrhea if you're trying to flush it out of your system. Mm-hmm. So those are two symptoms right there covered with that.
Even dehydration, if water's going to your brain and not where it's supposed to be.
You know what I mean? Definitely. And low blood mm-hmm. pressure.
Yes, it, like a fluid.
Mm-hmm.
100%. Yeah, it all makes sense when you start connecting the dots. Again, something we both had issues with was just the terminology, right? You went over this a million times.
This was the hardest thing for me to wrap my head around. It's called rabbit starvation. So are they starving to death or protein poisoning? Are they being poisoned to death? Because those are two different mechanisms. So one of the things that we came across in many of the different articles is they were both being suggested. So either they were being starved to death because when we break down protein, it's not very efficient to get a lot of calories out of it to use for fuel, or is it protein poisoning from all the ammonia buildup?
Exactly. So, and I think we did come up with one of our proposed mechanisms does cover both arguments, in my opinion, and it pretty much revolves around the rate limiting step in this reaction is our body's ability to produce urea. So there is a specific rate that our body can produce urea.
So for a 70 kilogram male, that's about a guy my size, the average typical explorer back then, they can convert 65 milligrams of ammonia into urea per hour. So that means about 250 grams of protein per day is able to be converted into urea without the buildup of ammonia. So just like when you become fat adapted, it makes you better able to mobilize fat for fuel. Regularly consuming high protein meals helps you regulate your urea cycle and helps your ability to metabolize ammonia into urea. So that you will be able to convert more into that, but
there is an upper limit.
There is an upper limit, and also you're not giving your body time to adapt to this type of diet.
Yes, this isn't, like somebody like me, I prep for this diet and I know what I'm doing. If we're back in the day, we're exploring 365, all of a sudden shit just gets hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you have the luxury of going to a grocery store like, oh, hey, this diet isn't working out. Let me up my fat. They don't have that option.
No. Mm-mm. No, their hand is forced and they don't have a lot of cards to play with.
And it's really, we know that we're hungry, but we don't really know what we're hungry for. So if you're hungry, you're just going to eat. You're just going to eat what's available.
Yes.
You don't really know, like, oh, hey, I should stop eating this meat and focus on the bone marrow, or stop eating the muscle and just focus on the fat. You don't really have those cues. Our bodies are smart, but they're not that smart.
Yeah.
So we're just like, we're hungry, we're just going to eat. So, like, yeah, we're actually just making the situation even worse. These people probably would have been better off if they were just fasting for the majority of the time instead of eating excess protein to the amount that they were.
Yes, I'm so glad you said that. They would have been. They would have been extremely, because you can, even though, if you look at, I guess I want to call them aboriginal societies, so kind of traditional-based societies, no one's going to be obese. Go look at people like Maasai in Africa, or somebody in like, or the Inuit. Even though people think the Inuit are heavy, it's more their facial structure. They're actually lean underneath all those heavy clothes, but they're not walking around at like 20% body fat. These people are lean. They're lean people because that's what they do. They live off the land. So these people, these explorers, at least back in the day when this stuff was actually being documented, were already lean to begin with. So doing this protein, this high protein diet, forced their body to utilize that little fat they had on them at an increased rate and forced them to use this energy. If they were just fasted, their fat stores on their body would have lasted longer. It would have lasted for months, not weeks. Because, and that's actually why we're getting into it, the process of turning ammonia into urea is very metabolically demanding. So simply put, the body can't extract enough ATP out of a very high protein diet, which is going to be over 45% of calories, to properly metabolize ammonia into urea, unless you have access to adequate body fat stores, which again, we do in America nowadays 100%. That's why for obese, the protein-sparing modified fast is a legitimate option to lose weight because they have so much excess energy on them. But back in the day when this stuff was happening and people were suffering from rabid starvation, they didn't have a lot of excess body fat. They had enough to go for a few weeks, but not much longer than that. So the body
didn't have that Krispy Kreme donut from 5 years ago to pull that body fat from.
Exactly, they didn't. So the body can pull from body fat to support this process of protein digestion, but that only lasts to a point. Once someone is really lean, even the fat on your body won't be enough to fully support this process. And we didn't talk about this, an estimate of like body fat percentage that would be too lean. I'm thinking, well, once you get down to what, 5-6%, there's just not a lot of fat left.
Oh, I was even gonna say pretty much like under 10.
Like it's not, where are we starting, 10? So that's not a lot of body fat.
Yeah, and think about how active these people are.
So they weren't fat.
Even if they started the expedition at 10%, mm-hmm. I'm sure they got down to like 8% pretty quick.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they didn't have a lot of body fat to actually support this. It's funny, on our little show notes, when you post this on Facebook, say, hey man, what's going on with this? What was a big thing you heard about pairing protein and fat?
Your body can't metabolize protein without fat.
Right? That's what you heard. And if you listen to this podcast religiously, I'm pretty sure I have said that because I have read that. And it makes sense because everywhere in nature, protein and fat are paired together. Think of a steak. I don't even give a shit if it's a chicken breast. There's going to be some fat in a chicken breast. They're always paired together. And they're usually paired at a good ratio of fat to protein. So it just makes sense to say you need fat to metabolize protein. So I went through literally the metabolism of amino acids and the metabolism of fat. And I was like, okay, where in this process is fat used? Like specifically, where are they combined? And they're not. Straight up, you do not need fat to metabolize protein. You don't. Now, what you do need is ATP. And I'm going to break down a little bit what's going on with this.
So that's why you can be a bodybuilder and build a shit ton of muscle eating chicken breast and broccoli. Because you have those carbohydrates to turn into ATP.
Exactly. Yeah, so you can live off, like, most a typical bodybuilding diet would be chicken with white rice. So you get the protein from the chicken. There's no fat to speak of. They're not putting butter on it or butter on the broccoli, but they're getting ATP from the rice to support protein metabolism. So that's why. And that was a question you proposed, right? You're like, so how can bodybuilders do this?
Yeah.
And we solved it. This is going to get a little more detailed for anybody out there who actually cares about the details. If not, you can probably just not pay attention to me ramble for the next few minutes, but I'll try and break this down as best I can, just really showing like where ATP is involved. So glutamate, just an amino acid that is used by the body to shuttle nitrogen to the liver to get converted into ammonia and then to urea to be excreted by the body. Glutamate undergoes oxidative deamination catabolized by the enzyme glutamate dehydrogenase, which is only found in the mitochondria, resulting in the creation of alpha-ketoglutarate and ammonia. And if you didn't know, alpha-ketoglutarate is a Krebs cycle intermediate, so it can be used for energy. Like we talked about in the protein and gluconeogenesis podcast, protein does get used in energy because it gets converted into these Krebs cycle intermediates like alpha-ketoglutarate. So this enzyme is an allosteric enzyme, meaning it can increase or decrease its activity given different signals. So given the demand by the body, it can increase or decrease its activity. So it increases activity in the presence of ADP, which is a low energy state, and it decreases activity in the presence of GTP. If you hear GTP, you can just think of it as ATP, which is a high energy state. So here's a little quote. Whenever a hepatocyte, which is a liver cell, needs fuel for the citric acid cycle, glutamate dehydrogenase activity increases, making alpha-ketoglutarate available for the citric acid cycle, releasing NH4 for excretion. So these people, do you think they're in a high energy state?
It doesn't sound like it based on the symptoms.
Fuck no, they're not, right? So they're in a low energy state. So this enzyme is going full tilt, okay? And normally this isn't a problem. The NH4, again, ammonium, gets converted into urea and everything is fine. So it's happening in me right now. It's happening in you right now. It's not a problem. However, the first step, because we have the energy to metabolize it properly, we're not starving. But however, the first step of converting NH4 ammonium into urea is ATP dependent. So here's a quote. Whatever its source, the NH4 generated in the liver mitochondria is immediately used together with bicarb produced by mitochondrial respiration to form carbonyl phosphate in the mitochondrial matrix. This ATP-dependent reaction is catalyzed by the enzyme carbonyl phosphatase, synthase 1. God, I fucked up that name. How do you pronounce that? Carbamoyl phosphate synthetase 1.
Sure.
I know, that's a hard enzyme. But this reaction, this is the very first reaction our body does to get this nitrogen out of our system, is dependent on ATP. So I believe right there, that is a bottleneck. That is where the system gets backed up.
So basically what he's saying is when ADP is present, when we have a lot of it, we have low energy. And that's what's happening in this state when you're in protein poisoning or rapid starvation. So what we need is we need to convert that ADP into ATP so we have energy. And when we have ATP, we cut off the AKG in the Krebs cycle. Because now we don't need to produce a lot of energy because we have a lot of ATP present. So that's pretty much what's going on there. And unfortunately, when these people are experiencing this rapid starvation, they don't have enough ATP to convert that ammonia into urea.
No. And it's not like nowadays, if we want access to ATP, we can get it. I can go get white rice right now. I can go get butter right now.
Coca-Cola, instant energy.
Instant energy, right? We can get calories right away. These people couldn't. Their only source of calories was this rabbit meat, which again was so lean and so lacking in fat that it simply could not provide adequate ATP to metabolize this nitrogen. So now what happens is the mitochondria is producing all this NH4, all this ammonium, and the NH4 gets pushed out back into the blood supply and the cytosol, which further depletes the ATP stores of the body as it tries to deal with this excess ammonium. So this is a quote. This is kind of long and kind of complicated, but I loved it, so I pulled it out. Ridding the cytosol of excess ammonia involves reductive amination of alpha-ketoglutarate to form glutamate by glutamate dehydrogenase. And if those words sound familiar, it's the exact same reaction I talked about earlier, but in reverse. So these reactions are kind of like in equilibrium. They can go left, they can go right, either way. So that's what happens, but it has to do it in reverse now. And conversion to glutamate to glutamine by glutamine synthetase, both of these enzymes occur in high levels in the brain, although the second probably represents a more important pathway for removal of ammonia. The first reaction depletes cellular NADH and alpha-ketoglutarate required for ATP production in the cell. The second reaction depletes ATP itself. Overall, NH3 may interfere with the very high levels of ATP production required to maintain brain function. Depletion of glutamate and the glutamine synthetase reaction may have additional effects on the brain. Glutamate and compound GABA, it's a gamma aminobutyrate that is derived from it, are both important neurotransmitters. The sensitivity of the brain to ammonia may well reflect a depletion of neurotransmitters as well as a change in cellular pH and ATP metabolism. That's a lot, and I'm sure people zoned out, but that's really what's going on and why we think the problem is a lack of ATP.
So essentially, protein does have 4 calories in it, but not as a fuel source, as Krebs cycle intermediates. If you're actually trying to break down those proteins into fuel, you're not getting 4 calories out of it. You're using 3, you're getting about 2 up back. So it's not really getting a good bang for your buck.
No, it's not. Yeah. So it has been estimated that because of the necessity of excreting nitrogen as urea instead of ammonia, urolytic, which are just animals that use urea, animals lose about 15% of the energy of the amino acids from which urea was derived. So simply eating protein requires to take energy from that to metabolize it. We don't have to worry about that with fat. Fat is damn near pure energy. We don't have to worry about carbohydrates. Carbohydrates are pure energy. But protein, we do. There's an extra step, and it is that nitrogen metabolism that is a problem. And also, I wanted to talk about I don't know if I've talked about ribose before. I think I did in the CoQ10 episode. Is that
ringing? I know we've talked about it. I just don't remember which episode.
Yeah, okay. I think maybe listen back to the CoQ10 episode. I talked about ribose a little bit, but that's a sugar that's a backbone of ATP and of our DNA and our RNA. So this is something that wasn't brought up as far as in the textbooks, but something I just connected the dots. So the nitrogen that does get into the urea cycle is 5 different enzymatic reactions, also further depletes the purine pool. And purine, like I just said, that's ribose. That's the backbone of ATP and also of DNA and RNA. And this is true because the enzyme arginosuccinate synthetase needs ATP to perform what it has to do, but in the process, it produces AMP, not ADP. And that's a big deal because AMP then gets metabolized into uric acid and excreted from the body. The only way to replenish the purine pool is to salvage it or make the sugar ribose through the pentose phosphate pathway. And that pathway requires glucose as a starting unit and is extremely slow. So normally when pathways produce, they use ATP and they produce ADP. That's really not a problem because ADP and ATP are recycled very quickly. It's easy. But once you take 2 phosphates off of ATP and make AMP, then that AMP can no longer get converted to ADP. It has to get metabolized. It has to get excreted from the body. And that depletes the purine pool. So overall, the urea cycle requires 3 ATP to perform. It yields 2 ADP and 1 AMP. So it further depletes the purine pool. And just think, it needs glucose. Our body needs glucose to rebuild that ribose. If we're starving, you think our body is going to use this glucose to produce ribose? It's going to use the glucose for essential metabolic functions because it's trying to survive. So it dials down everything else. So we're constantly, constantly depleting this purine pool and we're not replenishing it. And that's another reason why, because our body's just banking that tomorrow we're going to turn the corner and find like a moose or find a bear, something with excess calories. And then our body will take that and replenish the purine pool. But until then, it's not going to shuttle any glucose to the pentose phosphate pathway because it's using that glucose for essential functions, specifically cells that need glucose to survive.
And that glucose is going to get depleted rather quick. So one thing we
all day.
Yeah, one thing we talked about in a previous podcast is when you eat protein, glucagon is released at the same time, and it releases glycogen out into your bloodstream. So your glycogen stores are getting depleted right there. So you're going to have a little bit of high blood sugar. That's going to go away because the insulin's going to put it back in your cells for fuel. You're going to use up that fuel rather quick. You're exploring. You're doing a lot of
a 10-mile hike every day.
Yeah. What's the easiest thing you're doing? Rowing down the river, which is still pretty damn
hard. Hella hard. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know what the easiest thing that you're doing. So like no matter what, you're carrying a 50-pound pack. You're doing high intensity work all day, every day. That glucose and that glycogen is going to get used up really quick.
Exactly.
And you're not really being able to replenish it.
No, you're not. Exactly. What you need to do is rest and eat, which is 2 things people were not doing because they couldn't. So simply put, the body is poisoned by too much ammonia by being starved of adequate ATP needed to turn ammonia into urea. Boom. You don't need fat for protein. This isn't poisoning strictly. This isn't starvation strictly. It's a combination of both.
You know, it's crazy because I don't know how much I read on this and
could not. You didn't see this nowhere.
No.
I know. Yeah, nowhere.
How many back and forths did we have talking about this?
A lot.
We talked about this off the air for, I don't know, 5 hours plus, 10 hours, something
for like. Probably a month.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. We've been putting this podcast back just because we couldn't figure it out.
Yes, just because we couldn't figure it out, exactly. So, and again, I'm not saying 100% this is exactly the only thing that's going on. Is there other shit going on? Maybe, I don't know. But this makes perfect sense, and I don't know. I think this is a big part of what's going on.
And it answers that question, why is it called rabbit starvation and protein poisoning, when those 2 names don't really seem to make too much sense.
You don't know how many times Tom texted me this last month being like, what the fuck, it's protein poisoning, it's starvation.
Well, because every podcast or everything I read either pointed to one or the
other. Or the other. No one combined them.
Yeah. Nobody was asking that question that I was asking.
No, nobody was. And I'm glad he did, because that forced me, and I guess both of us, to really, I don't know, kind of widen the scope of, like, what are we looking at? What's going on? So, and I think we got a pretty good answer.
I'm happy with it.
I'm happy with it, too. I think it's actually pretty on point, and
If you guys have any information to dispute what we came up with, feel free to share it. I'm definitely open to reading more on this.
Me too.
Don't give me a textbook on it. I've read too much, but...
Oh, God. Yeah, seriously. I've had this damn tab open on my laptop for maybe... Probably since gluconeogenesis, strictly on protein metabolism. God, I'm so sick of looking at those damn, like, electron flow shit, like, as far as metabolism goes. I'm so sick of it.
When did we talk about doing this as a topic? Was that about a month ago? Was it gluconeogenesis?
It probably was gluconeogenesis, yeah. Yeah, because those were kind of came up as ideas at the same time.
Yeah, it was like, oh, too much protein, gluconeogenesis, too much protein. Yeah, that must have been when we came up with that.
Yeah. It turned out, you would think gluconeogenesis would have been more complex than this, but it really wasn't. You can Google gluconeogenesis and find 50 articles on it. I mean, that's what I did, but this was a little more, a little more hands-on, a little more critical thinking. And
it
luckily,
was all critical thinking.
It was all critical thinking, yeah, and luckily we both had a little bit of a background so we could read articles and pick out stuff that we knew was on the right track, but kind of not listen to shit that we knew was bogus.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Because one thing, all right, if we didn't do the deep dive into gluconeogenesis, one thing I was thinking is like, okay, well, your body can just create all this glucose from all this protein, and it shouldn't really be a problem. Like, yeah. Why would you starve to death if you can do that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But we know what's really going on. Boom, that was a really good, I really like that.
Yeah. I hope everybody else liked that too. We put a lot of thought, a lot of time into this.
A lot of time went into this. You feel like we covered it pretty good?
I'm happy with it. I don't really know what more we could do to cover this topic.
No, me either. Do you want to go on to the tip of the week?
Yeah, this is a really easy tip of the week. This is something that everybody should be doing. So it's if you work out for an hour a day, yeah, you can get the aesthetics that you want. You can get those six-pack abs. You can lose a bunch of weight. You can get the aesthetics that you want. But 1 hour a day is only 4% of the day. So you're not really getting all the health benefits from just going to the gym for an hour and then sitting on your ass for the rest of the day. So one thing that our ancestors did and one thing that we should all be doing more is we should be doing a lot more walking. So when our muscles contract, especially in our lower body, they act as a pump. So when our leg muscles contract, they're forcing venous return, so that's blood that's not oxygenated, back to our heart. Our heart is our hardest working organ. So, you know, like, let's give it a break from time to time. Let's not make it work super hard. And when we contract our leg muscles, that's helping the blood overcome gravity. So that's a lot of work that your heart has to do when you're sitting down, no contractions in your leg muscles. Think of how far your feet are from your heart, how much, that's a few feet of blood pressure that's required. So your heart has to work really hard to pump that blood back to your heart coming from your feet. And then it's not just about blood. You have lymphatic fluid, which is responsible for transporting fat for energy, white blood cells for immune support, and it also drains interstitial fluid. That prevents stuff like swelling. So like if you're sitting on an airplane for, you know, 6 hours, that's why your feet will swell up. If you take your shoes off, you might not be able to put them back on after that. And that's just because you're not contracting your leg muscles and getting rid of that interstitial fluid. So that popular recommendation of taking 10,000 steps a day, you know, it's not really going to get you into shape. It's not going to help you lose a lot of weight, but it does make a lot of sense when you take into these factors about lymphatic fluid and blood return. So just a few ways to get a few extra steps in during the day. When you go to the store, park a little farther away. Don't fight for that closest parking spot. If you work in an office building, try to use a bathroom on a different floor. So, you know, you're having to walk up and down the stairs, taking a few extra steps. Hey, and you know what? It even gives you a little bit of a longer break. And then you know what? If you have a dog, take your dog for a walk. Listen to a great podcast like the one you're listening to right now. Hey, if you're one of those people that goes to Starbucks or Pete's Coffee, don't use the drive-thru. Park and actually walk inside the store. Get a little bit of exercise. Get some social contact. Talk to somebody face-to-face for a change. You know, that type of thing. So these are just a few tips to get you a few extra steps, and I hope this helps out.
Yeah, that's great advice. Get moving. Don't expect to, you know, get jacked from a walk, but just overall health, it'll help. All right, that's another episode in the books. Thank you for listening. You can find us at TNTWellnessAndNutrition.com. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, so if you have any questions, comments, or concerns, feel free to reach out.
Yeah, please rate and subscribe to the podcast. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and SoundCloud. I hope everybody has a happy and healthy week.